Okay, great. So first of all, just say it's really lovely to see you all here. It's very nice to be down here in Croydon. I worked at the Mayday Hospital many years ago, 6 months, and did come a few times at that time to this centre. So it's very nice to be back here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a bit about myself and Vimalasar and how we came to write this book. I'll then say a little bit about why we've called the book what it's called, and then talk about the steps, go through a bit about what's in the book. So so just to start with myself and how I, from my side, how I came to be writing this book. So as you heard, I'm a psychiatrist. I specialize in addictions, and I got involved in Buddhism 30 years ago. At the same time, I was a medical student. So in a way, I had sort of two things running in parallel. I had my interest in Buddhism and the Dharma, and particularly in terms of how I could work with my mind to change myself. At the same time, I became increasingly interested and then ended up specializing in psychiatry, again, because of the interest in the mind and how one can work with the mind and Western ideas of the mind and psychological approaches. I ended up specializing in addictions, and it seemed to me, really quite early on, that there were obvious interesting overlaps between Buddhism on the one hand and addiction on the other hand. So an obvious and perhaps the most obvious example is the importance of craving. So craving's a key part of addiction and compulsive behaviours. This also a key part of the Buddha's teaching. It's the second noble truth. So you've got the first noble truth is suffering, the second noble truth, the cause of suffering or unsatisfactoriness, is craving. So there seem to be obvious overlaps. And about 20 years ago, somebody from the West London Centre, Mitrananda, suggested we write a paper. He was also a psychiatrist in addictions. He suggested, why don't we write a paper on Buddhism and addictions, which is what we do, and published it. And it was quite interesting, about then looking at some of these, I mean, some of the obvious overlaps, like I've mentioned, about craving. But for example, I also discovered, which I hadn't known before that time, that even the Buddha sort of addressed sort of specific addiction problems. So there's a very nice story about a king asked to see him, and the king, he said he was having a bit of a problem because he couldn't get up and he was very sleepy and tired all the time. And I mean, it probably didn't take a great physician to diagnose it, but basically the problem was he was hugely overweight from eating too much. So he basically had an addiction to food. The Buddha, being the physician, came up with a program, which you could see, nowadays think of as almost like a sort of very good behavioral program. So what he did is he got the prince involved. So again, that's a very good treatment thing, get the family involved in treatment. So he got the prince and he said, look, okay, what I want you to do is when you serve up the meal to the king, you give the king his huge, great, rice and all these different curries and so on. But when he comes to the last mouthful, you stop him and you don't let him have the last mouthful of food. And then if he protests and complains, you recite this verse. And he gave him a verse to recite, which was reminding the king that actually it really wasn't a good idea to scoff all this food, and that if you wanted to stop, if you wanted to be able to move about and not be so tired, you needed to not eat as much. So the prince put that into action, and the ki and basically so yeah, just one of the bits. The king's not allowed to have the last mouthful of food, but then the next day the meal only has the food that he actually ate, and again it's one mouthful less. So each day it was like a mouthful of, you know, a handful of less food. So happy ending. The king duly loses weight, and to his surprise, starts feeling much better. He's able to walk along, you know, and gets around. So yeah, so it's just a, you know, nice little story of, you know, which I discovered in my researches at that time of you know, the Buddha responding to addiction. But in a way, there's a thing about, as I said, the salience of craving and some other principles, in a way, are sort of more important. And, you know, one of the things that I suggested at the time, or we suggested at the time, was that mindfulness might be a useful thing to help with addiction. So we published our paper, this was 20 years ago, and then we did nothing about it. But there we are. However, about 10 years ago, I started getting interested in the mindfulness-based approaches for depression. So MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And it just seemed to me that it would be a good idea if we started teaching that at the London Buddhist Centre. And I had one of those moments where, you know, I suggested, wouldn't it be good if we, like preferably somebody else, did this? And everybody looked at me. So I ended up starting to teach MBCT at the Buddhist Centre. And then, you know, starting to teach that, it seemed, because of my addictions background, it seemed immediately obvious that it would be a good idea to adapt it for addiction. So I did a sort of kind of search and replace job, and you know, search depression, replace with addiction, threw in a bit of standard CBT-ish approaches in addiction, and put together a mindfulness-based relapse prevention course, which I've been teaching at the London Buddhist Centre, particularly in what later became Breathing Space, our health and well-being wing, and also been teaching that in the National Health Service. And so starting to deliver MBRP for addiction, well, it's obviously it wasn't a panacea, but I definitely sort of thought that it could, you know, it could be really helpful. I mean, again, sort of interestingly, sort of different responses. So this is me teaching in the you know, in the health service. And the thing about working in the NHS, you know, I work in a complex needs service, so it's people from quite difficult backgrounds. They're not necessarily also, you know, verbal, sophisticated, etc. The sort of people that we sometimes get at the London Buddhist Centre. So it's a slightly different. I'll just go on a little detour. I remember years ago I did. I was doing a psychotherapy group training, and part of that is you had to be in a group. So, you know, so we're doing this group, and someone would sort of start being a bit argumentative towards the therapist of the group. And the group therapist would say something like, oh, you know, I wonder why it is that, you know, you're feeling a bit irritable at the moment. And the person goes, oh, yes, I am feeling, that's really interesting. I wonder why I'm feeling irritable. So then, you know, next day I come along to my group in the NHS and try a similar sort of thing, and they say, why don't you answer the question, you know, sort of thing. So, so, you know, a little bit different working in the NHS from, you know, other situations. Anyway, so I was doing MBRP in the NHS and teaching this mindfulness-based approaches, and after about the second week, one of the guys said, what I've realised is that when I have a bath, I start by washing my left foot first, and then I wash the rest of my body. So I sort of did it, you know, one of those things where you don't really know what to say, just go, oh, that's very good, that's very interesting. So I thought, oh, well, let's see. Anyway, it was very good. He stuck the six-week course and then came to the end of the course, and people were sort of saying how they'd got on, and he said, yeah, what I've discovered is that when I have a bath, I still start by washing my left foot first. I don't know why that is, but that's what I still do. So I'm still doing the nodding. You know, not sure what to do with this. By contrast, again, one of the early groups, there was a chap came along, and he was some friends of his gave him a dog to look after overnight. So they said, okay, yeah, I'll look after your dog. What he didn't realize until he was with the dog is actually the dog had a terminal illness and was in fact dying. And as the night went on, the dog was obviously becoming more unwell and clearly dying. And he found himself becoming quite upset and distressed by this. Now, for this guy, that was just not on. You know, that was not something he did. He didn't do upset and distressed. And his response to that was one of anger and irritation. You know, why am I getting upset? It's not even my dog, for heaven's sake. And, you know, why have they done this? You know, why have they landed me with this dying dog? So a lot of anger. And for him, anger, how he'd normally respond to feeling angry is to pick up a drink. However, he'd been doing the course with me, and he remembered some of the ideas from the course, particularly this idea of being with your difficulties. And he thought, okay, so I'm angry. He sort of, in a way, allowed himself to be angry. And when doing that, he allowed himself to be upset. And he then found he was crying, and he allowed himself to cry, which for him was just like unheard of. And the important thing was he didn't pick up a drink. And then he came back and he just reported, and he was just so happy that he'd seen, gone through that whole experience and not picked up a drink. So, I thought, when people actually get it, it could make a real difference in their lives and really promote their recovery. Around the same time I was doing that, there's somebody in America who, sadly deceased, but an important person in the development of relapse prevention called Alan Marlett. And he was also interested in using mindfulness, and at the same time came up with a course which is actually pretty much identical, by the way, with the same name, MBRP. And he worked in an academic department. He did some studies looking at the effectiveness and found, some support in that suggested that mindfulness-based relapse prevention was successful. So this in a way started, moving, in a way bringing some elements of Buddhism as the Dharma into my addiction work. Now, Vimalasara has a slightly different story. For her, she struggled particularly with eating, also had a bit of a drug habit at one time. And for her, the Buddhism was really the place where, she put it, she cleaned up. In the meditation room is where she cleaned up. And if you read 8-Step Recovery, which I hope you will, she gives a very moving account of her own journey to overcome her addiction, particularly to food. So what she realized is that the Dharma had really helped her in terms of her own recovery. And she started teaching mindfulness-based relapse prevention, and as Dipak actually mentioned in the introduction, running this Recovery Mondays. So bringing Dharma to people in recovery in Vancouver. And it was really her idea that actually there's whole riches in the Buddhist tradition that could be help with people's recovery, and that it'd be worth writing a book on it. So she had the idea. She invited me to join her, and we duly wrote the book. So thanks to Windhorse for publishing it. We also decided to change the name of MBRP to Mindfulness-Based Addiction Recovery, because I think one part of the things is, in a way, the thrust of our thinking is moving away from merely just preventing relapse into addictive behaviour. This whole thing of recovery, of a much sort of richer, fuller life that recovery implies. So we decided to call it 8-Step Recovery. maybe a little bit cheekily, you know, one of my work colleagues said, "Oh, what happened to the four steps?" Because I'm sure you'll know, as soon as one thinks about you know, help for addiction, 12 steps comes to mind. So what I did want to say is, although we've called our book 8-Step Recovery, some people have asked us, is this, you know, like a criticism of the 12-step approach? And I'd certainly say it's not a criticism of the 12-step approach at all, because, you know, I know for many people it's very helpful. I encourage my patients to try it, Bimlasara found it helpful. You know, if there was a criticism, it's only to say, you know, there's no one thing, and I would include 8-step recovery and the sort of treatment I offer at work that suits everybody. There was more to it there than just merely that, you know, 12 steps, so we'll have 8 steps, so we'll do the quick version. It wasn't really just that. We initially tried to fit it into the Eightfold Path, because that's an important teaching in Buddhism. But actually that didn't work, so we got rid of that idea. But the word step seemed to stay with us. And I think partly it's to realizing that actually steps has a very venerable history in Buddhism. One of the most famous writings, pieces of literature in Buddhism, is the Dhammapada. And pada means step. From step, it comes to mean verse, so you've got like these verses of the Dhammapada, but that's the origin, it's to do with steps. And the Buddha, of course, walked throughout northern India teaching the Dharma. He was on foot, he went step by step around all over India. And in early representations of the Buddha, they didn't used to use a figure of the Buddha. So you'd maybe have like a stone frieze, which would have the disciples as, you know, sort of these various human forms. But where the Buddha was, instead of actually having a human figure, they'd put a symbol. So it might be something like a tree, so representing the Bodhi tree, or it might be a chair or a wheel, representing the wheel of the Dharma, the teaching of the Dharma. But one of the popular ones was the footprints of the Buddha. So this idea of the Buddha stepping out into the world to teach the Dharma. So steps has got very, very positive connotation in Buddhism. And, you know, in a way that was part of, you know, wanting, you know, why I think for us it resonated as a title for the book. So I'm going to tell you a bit about the 8 steps now. So I'll read them out. Bimlasara's managed to learn them by heart. I'm afraid I've not been so good as that. We were doing on Friday, we had an interview at the London Buddhist Centre with Maitreya Bandi, your president, interviewing us, which was very nice. And he asked me about the steps, and I had to keep saying, okay, so step one, and Bimlasara, tell me what the step is. And I said, well, that is about step two, and that is about... That's quite fun. Anyway, so I'm going to read them out to you. So the first step is accepting that this human life will bring suffering. 2 is seeing how we create extra suffering in our lives. 3, embracing impermanence to show us that our suffering can end. 4, being willing to step onto the path of recovery and discover freedom. 5, transforming speech, actions, and livelihood. 6, placing positive values at the centre of our lives. 7, making every effort to stay on the path of recovery. And 8, helping others by sharing the benefits we have gained. So yes, I'm just going to talk about that. So the first three, in a way, I think of the first three steps in a way as being like laying the groundwork. It's about very much about learning how our mind works, and very much informed by mindfulness-based approaches, mindfulness-based addiction recovery, but in a way going deeper than MBR or the other mindfulness-based approaches usually do. So the first two steps are link very closely to the first two noble truths, the truth of suffering and the truth of how we create suffering through craving. So in a way that these steps here, it's very much about really clocking that inevitably we will suffer at some points in our lives. You know, we had that show of hands, which was nul point for anyone who'd never experienced a negative mental state. We all experience negative mental states. We all experience suffering. Even though we experience pleasure as well, we experience pain. And the key part of this is really noticing this, because it's so easy to avoid it, so easy to not notice it, to turn away from it. And I find a useful sort of heuristic comes from Aya Kama. She suggests there are three main responses we have to suffering. The first is to blame. So it's the, you know, the kicking the cat phenomenon that we so easily do. Or we fall into self-pity, poor me. And the thing about blame, and self-pity, I mean, partly I just notice how easy it's, you know, sort of like how my mind just defaults to it. You know, I'll be at home, I can't find something, and, you know, instantly the thought is, okay, who's moved it? You know, I sort of, you know, just like straight out there, you know. I'm not going to have this unpleasant experience. I'm going to blame somebody, because there must be somebody else who's responsible for the reason why I can't find my, you know, whatever it is, or why I'm suffering, must be because of somebody else. So it just happens so quickly. So the trouble with those things, blame and self-pity, is it means that we're not in the driving seat of our lives. So it's like we sort of, in a way, we hand over our power, we become powerless. So they're really not very helpful. They just get us stuck. The third approach that we often take to suffering is to distract ourselves. Now, well, that's got some mileage in it. You know, there's definitely a moment when it can be quite useful to just consciously, deliberately, okay, this is really unpleasant, I'm going to go and watch a movie now, you know, and there's definitely a place for that. But you can see how very easily, when that's done as an automatic response, and depending on what the response is, how that can lead us into trouble. So if we start increasingly relying on drink, on pornography, on gambling, on the internet, on food, how we start easily moving into addictive behavior as a consequence. So so the first part of it is just seeing how we do this, just seeing how we try and escape our suffering, and in doing so easily create more suffering. As Shantideva, who's the wrote the puja, said, you know, we don't want to suffer, but we're attached to the causes of suffering. Way, see that very strongly in addiction. We don't want to suffer, but actually the very thing that we do to try and alleviate our suffering causes more suffering. The third step, which again relates to this sort of basic found, you know, groundwork, is about seeing impermanence, so seeing change. And partly seeing change is important because if we unconsciously think things are fixed, we're going to suffer. So it could be another aspect of our cause of suffering. But importantly, if we see things can change, we can start to realize that we can change. So, you know, what, again, one of the sort of, you know, sort of almost truisms in addiction theory is that you want to change your addiction. But if you don't believe anything's going to work, if you don't think you can change, you won't try. So actually seeing that you can change is a really important condition to help one change one's difficulty, change one's addiction. So those are the first three steps. Step four is like starting to move into making bigger changes in our lives, and this is particularly working with our motivation. So we're starting to see how the mind works. So then we're trying to move into really desiring to make changes, and partly this draws on psychological approaches that I use a lot in my NHS work, motivational interviewing, which is about enhancing our motivation to change. It's about an honest appraisal of the advantages and disadvantages of our addictive behaviour. But also in this step, there's a big emphasis on kindness. So kindness, metta, maitri, is a key quality of the Buddha's teaching. And it's a very important quality that we bring into as we start to see how our mind works. If we start to see that, okay, yeah, here I am causing my suffering, and we're just, wagging our finger at ourselves, it's going to be really hard to change. We're just creating more suffering. As soon as we can start to bring a kinder, more compassionate approach to ourselves, like, for example, doing, responding to the four basic needs of the heart that we did before tea, then it makes it more possible to move towards change. It's important how we engage with our problematic behaviours and the desire to change. If it needs to be rooted in kindness, if it's really going to have legs, as it were. And of course, the thing about compulsive addictive behaviours is that when we're in that state, we very easily override kindness, both to ourselves and other people. It's, you get focused in on the addictive behaviour and other things go out the window. So again, that's another reason why it feels very important to, if you like, reintroduce or introduce a stronger kindness. So having, as it were, done that, we're then more in a position to make, if you like, bigger changes or changes in our external life. And so step five is about transforming speech, action, and livelihood. Again, for those of you familiar with 12 steps, you can see a link with the idea of making a fearless moral inventory. From our perspective as Buddhists, it's really about the ethics, which is a very important part of Buddhism. And in particular, facing up to our past unskillfulness, because again, when we're in the sort of the mindset that drives addiction, it's very easy to engage in things that we may later regret. And one of the things, one of the conundrums that can happen is that, and I see this a lot in the people I work with drink problems, is that you give up the drink, and then things start coming home to roost in terms of things that you now regret having done, particularly perhaps when you were, intoxicated. And often, to people that you actually care about. And also you see the other side of that can happen is that, sort of like, okay, now you're sober, so other people can have a bit of a go at you because you're actually there to have a go at. So you start to recognize your past unskillfulness, and this can lead to quite a lot of shame, which is a very painful mental state. So again, the importance of kindness and learning how to respond to this mind state and come to terms with past unhelpful actions and the suffering that they have caused. So this is a key part of this step, but also learning new behavior that's going to reap more helpful, positive benefits. And then looking more broadly at livelihood. So it's partly thinking about, where we get money that supports us, and is that in a way that is conducive to a healthy lifestyle. And if we're in paid work, that's going to likely to take a significant proportion of our time. So again, we want that to be something that is supportive of recovery, supportive of sobriety, rather than something that gets in the way or makes it harder. And that might be just simply, it might be the job itself, whether that's unhelpful or not, or it might be our approach to the job, you know, how we're going about it. Step six is about identifying our values. So if we're really going to keep going and get going with recovery, one thing that can be very helpful is to identify what values are important to us. It's like by being in contact with our values, what's important, it gives us a bigger perspective. It frames our life in a bigger perspective. It makes it easier to keep going when times are difficult, when we know where we're trying to get to, when we know what we're trying to do. So in a way, it's a very personal thing what our values are. In Buddhism, or for myself as a Buddhist and Sarah as a Buddhist, there's sort of three key values are the three jewels, the Buddha, the ideal of human awakening, the Dharma, the teachings, and reality that the teachings point to, and the Sangha, the spiritual community. So we in this chapter we look at those, either because you might be interested, you know, if you're a Buddhist, as sort of using those three jewels and how they can help in recovery, or as a sort of like a paradigm, as an example of important values. So you can see, for example, with Sangha, the third jewel, in a way, part of that is just having people around you who can support your recovery. If all the people who are around you are engaged in addictive behaviours, it's much harder to make changes. Step seven is about staying on the path. It's about keeping going. So it's again, it's about looking at our mind, looking at mind states, and looking at mind states that can be helpful, that can support our recovery, and ones that get in the way, almost like roadblocks. And includes some elements of Western psychological approach to relapse prevention, so about preventing relapse. Also about, in a way, cultivating quality of vigilance. The Buddha's last words were with vigilance, strive on. Sometimes said is with mindfulness, but the actual word is vigilance. So the importance of vigilance in keeping going. And then the final step is about helping others. Again, that's something that appears in the 12 steps, but it's also a key part of Buddhism. There's a very nice little section in Wisdom Beyond Words by Sangharakshita, where he says, you can't help other people without helping yourself, and you can't help yourself without helping other people. So you've got this sort of two-way relationship, which in a way, partly, I think, just points to our interdependent, interconnected nature. If we try and wall ourselves off from other people, well, actually, reality is not like that. And if we try and sort of bring down the barriers and close ourselves off, we're likely to create difficulties for ourselves. Whereas if we can turn towards others, if we can experience our connectedness, our kinship, which is the root of kindness, if we can experience our kinship with each other, we're more likely to help each other, or put it the other way around. If we help each other, we're more likely to experience that connectedness, which means that we create less trouble for ourselves. It's also, there's another reason why this is important, which is there have been a whole set of studies done in the addictions sort of field, looking at who is successful in recovering from addiction. And one of the key things is having contact with people further along their journey of recovery. For those of you who know the life story of the Buddha, you get this thing of the foresight of the Buddha. So the Buddha, when he's still at home, having an existential crisis, wondering what to, you know, having the existential crisis, the short version, he sees a wanderer and thinks, could this be a way to freedom? But there's something about seeing a possibility. So if you see somebody who's further in recovery, again, it just makes it more real, that the possibility. So that's another aspect of why helping others is important, even if it's just to be that exemplar, very, very important. So just say a few words of what we've got in the book. So in the book, you'll find there are exercises, there are meditations, there are people's stories, our own stories. There's a link to where you can download meditations and exercises that we lead. And in terms of who the book's for, I mean, Vimla Sara in a way mentioned this already. It's certainly for anyone who's struggling with addictive behaviour, who's in the recovery on the journey of recovery. But in a way, it's for any of us who struggle with addictive, compulsive behaviours, mind states. And as I talked about stinking thinking. And we, you know, in a way, we really wrote it as a, if you like, as an offering, as a contribution. Towards helping anyone who wants to deepen their recovery. So yeah, we hope you'll buy the book. We hope you'll use it. We hope you'll share it with people. And also, we'd be very happy to get feedback. We've got a page on thebuddhistcenter.com. If you go there and look for 8 steps, you'll find us. And we will be putting up a place where you can put feedback.